You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrer. Coming up, the public had its first chance to hear from the only candidate to advance in the search for a new UW system president. We'll talk to a higher education reporter about the story and where the process goes next. Now, a ban on evictions in Wisconsin expired in late May, yet hundreds of thousands of people in the state have lost work. It's making it hard to pay rent in full and on time, and landlords are now considering whether to remove people from their homes. Allison Dukanovich reports for News 414. That's a collaboration between Wisconsin Watch, Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service, and Outlier Media. Allison wrote about what renters need to know. Here she is talking with WPR host Keely Boltina.
Nonprofits are reporting that more renters are asking for help now that evictions are happening again in Wisconsin. What do we know about that?
We know that there was a ban on evictions during the pandemic when a lot of people were losing work and businesses were closing. Governor Tony Evers issued that ban at the end of March, and it expired on May 26th. So now, even though hundreds of thousands of Wisconsinites are still waiting for unemployment benefits to kick in, landlords can now begin evicting tenants or be in the process of eviction for tenants who have been unable to pay at this time.
And how do we know, that this is a problem for people? Where are they reaching out, and what kind of feedback are we getting?
Tenants are reaching out. Well, tenants have been reaching out to us directly. So I work on a project called News 414, which is a new texting news service that people can text in. It's primarily serving those in Milwaukee neighborhoods. So anyone in Milwaukee can text the word Milwaukee to the number 73224. To engage with our service and ask questions and get resources right now. And so one of the biggest things that people have been asking us about is housing resources, rent assistance, support with being able to stay in their homes at this time because they are worried about being at risk of eviction. I also have been talking with folks with different service providers in Milwaukee, one being an organization called Community Advocates that has a rental helpline that renters can call and get all sorts of assistance and help, either getting emergency rent payments or getting legal assistance or just advice. And the woman who runs that phone line says that the numbers of people calling have tripled in the past few weeks leading up to that day when the ban expired.
Wow. And this is a statewide issue, but it's a big one in Milwaukee. Why?
Eviction has been a big issue in Milwaukee, but at this time during the pandemic, with so many people losing work, but also so many renters in Milwaukee are what's considered rent burdened, where people are paying more than 30% of their income on rent. And more than half of households in Milwaukee are renters. So there's a large number of people who rent their homes, and then there's a large percentage of those people who are spending a big portion of their income on rent. So if they lose their income, that kind of wiggle room of being able to afford rent is pretty slim. And so people are struggling to be able to make their rent at a time when work is not available. Even before the pandemic, some Milwaukee neighborhoods saw as many as 10 to 15% of households experiencing an eviction in a given year. So that is already an issue that is definitely impacting renters in Milwaukee. And so given even more challenging economic circumstances, it's an issue that is growing exponentially from what I've been hearing.
And you report that Milwaukee has relatively high eviction totals in the spring and the summertime. Do we know why that is?
It's hard to say, and I don't want to say something that I don't know, but from what I have heard kind of anecdotally, it seems that it's kind of seasonal in the sense that it's very difficult to move in Wisconsin in the middle of winter. And I think that just anecdotally from what I've heard that landlords and tenants, some at least, try to prevent displacing someone from their home in the dead of winter. And so then those numbers tend to spike up in the spring and summer. If people have been behind on payments for that time.
Yeah, we know Wisconsin has lost hundreds of thousands of jobs in this pandemic. Is that really where this groundswell starts, people losing paychecks, and that is the direct issue when it comes to evictions?
I mean, there's a lot of reasons why someone could be evicted from their home, but I do think, like, some people that I have talked to who are answering these calls from renters, getting messages from renters who are calling all through the night, folks who maybe lost work and are waiting for unemployment payments to come through or waiting for that stimulus check to come through. A lot of the buffers that have been put in place to keep people afloat, from what I've been hearing, have not necessarily gotten to people in time to make that rent payment. So from what I've heard, the problem has been exacerbated by people losing work at this time, but I don't think it's fair to say that that's the only reason. There's a ton of reasons why someone could be at risk of eviction if they have higher health costs at this time or different. If anything else happens in a family, a lot of renters in Milwaukee, like I said, are paying a large portion of their income towards their rent. So if there is some kind of unexpected major expense, that can make it difficult to choose which bills to pay at the end of the month.
We're talking with Allison Dukanovich, who is with Wisconsin Watch. She reports for News 414, which is a collaboration between Wisconsin Watch and Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service and Outlier Media. And we're talking about evictions now that the Evers administration's temporary ban on evictions has gone away, and landlords are trying to figure out what to do as they consider removing people from their homes this summer. And Allison, I do wonder about that, because evictions, they don't just happen. There is a process. So how does eviction work in our state?
I'm happy to talk about the process, but I think it's also important to acknowledge, too, that there is assistance that's available. So if anyone is in this situation, if you're a landlord or if you're who's debating what to do, if you're having trouble paying your own bills, or if you're a tenant who's having trouble paying rent, there are different opportunities to get rent assistance. And so I think that's important to note. But the process of eviction in Wisconsin, at first it starts with what's called a notice. And so a landlord needs to properly serve. There's a certain procedure that a landlord needs to serve their tenant an eviction notice. And that will say, in most cases, it will say you have 5 days to either pay the amount of rent that's due or to vacate the building. And so at that point, the tenant has 5 days to try to come up with those emergency funds to pay that back. They still have kind of time if they want to work out some kind of formal agreement with their landlord, like a payment plan or something like that. When that notice is filed, that's not the court date. That's kind of this 5-day buffer. And then after that 5 days has expired is when the landlord can go ahead and file the official eviction complaint, and that's when they'll schedule a court date. Then a tenant has the right to appear in court. A tenant they're not entitled to legal representation, but there are organizations that can provide legal services to tenants seeking representation in court. And then after that court date is when the sheriff could go through and carry out the eviction.
You mentioned rent assistance, but you also mentioned this idea that even though eviction is a really scary word for most people, the fact is that there may be time and that there may be opportunities where people could talk with a landlord or explain what happened if their unemployment hasn't come in or something, that the fact that there's a notice does not mean that that's the end of it and they're out of their home.
Just kind of to build off of that point you just made, Keely, from everyone that I talked to who is helping provide assistance to renters, they're saying that as soon as you know if you're in some kind of financial difficulty, if you're experiencing some kind of financial difficulty, you know you're going to have trouble paying rent that month, to talk with your landlord as soon as possible, even before that notice is filed. So if you know that you lost work, you know that you're waiting for money to come in, you know that your circumstance changed in some way, to start that conversation with your landlord as soon as possible, so that some kind of agreement can hopefully be reached before the eviction process even begins.
Allison, thank you for breaking it down for us. We appreciate your reporting.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me here.
That was Allison Dukanovich with News 414 here in Wisconsin, talking to WPR host Keely Baltina. They talked about evictions in the weeks and months to come now that a temporary ban has expired. You can read her full report online, and we've posted some resources for rent assistance on our website. Just visit WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up, the single finalist for UW System President took questions from faculty and staff yesterday. We'll talk about what we learned and a petition from about 2,000 faculty, staff, and students calling for a new search. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Democrats in Congress released a wide-ranging police reform bill this week. We'll find out what the bill would change and how the Republican-controlled Senate is responding. First, the single finalist in the search for a new UW system president took questions yesterday in an open virtual campus forum. Jim Johnson is currently president of the University of Alaska system. His candidacy has gotten some pushback from thousands of staff, faculty, and students at UW who say they want to start the search over entirely. A note for listeners before we get started, WPR is under the administration of UW-Madison. Kelly Meyerhofer is an education reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. She covers higher education. Kelly, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, what did we hear from Jim Johnson yesterday?
So Mr. Johnson, he participated. There was one campus forum that was open to the public, and he got about a dozen questions from faculty and staff, and there was one student who was also allowed to ask questions. He talked about how he wants to strengthen shared governance in Wisconsin, and that's the like decision-making process where faculty and staff and students provide input and lend their expertise to broad decisions that are made at the system level. So he said he wants to strengthen that. He also talked about how he wants to advocate for more state money for the system by visiting lawmakers like within their districts and developing close relationships with them.
I want to check in on one of the things he said. This is Johnson answering a question about how he would make sure students could attend local campuses closer to where they live.
I don't think it would be fair to students where they live across the state to simply shrink the University of Wisconsin into the great big cities. That's not to say that those institutions are not great. They are there in Madison, Milwaukee. But I think it's absolutely critical that students have access as close as possible to home. But it's got to be cost effective as well.
And that's been a theme with the current administrator, the current president, Ray Cross. The campuses around the state staying open, but maybe reducing the number of majors that they offer, consolidating those. Did that come up as we heard from this candidate?
Yeah, the UW system's plan to start looking at like academic programs and potentially cutting some of them, that specific plan did not come up. Dr. Johnson didn't bring it up, but I mean, he talked a lot about like college access and program cuts, which is interesting because he's, you know, confronting a lot of those same problems at his own campus in Alaska. And just last week, the Board of Regents there voted to cut or reduce, I think it's like more than like 40 programs.
I want to go back a little bit and look at this process. It's unusual, I understand, to go through the process and end up with only one finalist. Can you talk about how we ended up there?
Yeah, previously, under state law, the UW system, whenever there were high-profile positions like this, searches for these positions, they had to name multiple finalists. The university's leaders have long pushed for changes to that law that they say, you know, need to protect applicants and their confidentiality. And in 2015, a change was made that allowed them to only publicly name applicants that are seriously considered for final consideration. So they can, this is a case where they say, oh, well, there was only one applicant who's seriously considered for final consideration. So they are complying with the law. But this is the first time for a system presidential search that there's only been one finalist named. And a lot of people have problems with that.
And do I have this right? Some potential finalists had pulled out of the process before the part where their names came out in the public because they didn't want to look bad to their current job?
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of been a trend throughout all of higher education where, you know, leaders are reluctant to be publicly named because then people at their current campus will think, oh, they're not committed, they're looking to leave. And then if they don't get the job, it just puts them in a really awkward position. In this specific search, the search committee chairman said the coronavirus played a role in that the leaders, the other applicants, were hesitant to be named because it would affect their ability to respond to the coronavirus on their campus.
We're talking to Kelly Meyerhofer, higher education reporter at the Wisconsin State Journal, looking at the quest to fill the position being vacated by Ray Cross as president of the University of Wisconsin system. Only one finalist now in the process. Kelly, you started to touch on this. What do we know about this one candidate, Jim Johnson, and his tenure in Alaska?
Yeah, I mean, Alaska, like a lot of different states, including Wisconsin, face a host of problems in higher education. They have fewer students enrolling, which means less money. They've also received a lot of budget cuts from the legislature. And last summer, a proposed cut from the governor would have cut like 41% of their state budget. So that sort of sent them into crisis, and the board of regents there declared financial exigency, which is this kind of fancy term that basically says, you know, the amount of money that is on the table to be cut, you know, threatens our, you know, future institution, like its ability to operate. So they've had a lot of financial crises. Dr. Johnson proposed a lot of pretty substantial reforms, like consolidating all the campuses into one university, restructuring it, but that was not approved. So, yeah, I mean, people that I've spoken to there say that he has a vision to respond to these, but a lot of times that vision is not always inclusive, according to the faculty there.
Now, turning to faculty and staff here, there's this petition calling on the UW system to start the search over. What's behind that? What are they saying?
Yeah, I think there's a couple things with that petition. The first major concern that a lot of people had, even before Jim Johnson's name entered this conversation, was, you know, the search committee that's been looking for the next president didn't include any faculty or staff, and it included one student who also serves on the board. In previous searches, the committee was much larger, and it included faculty and staff who could provide input. So they feel pretty shut out of the process, and so that they're calling it a failed search, and they say it needs to be restarted. And then the fact that only one finalist was named, and it's a person who they see as having a troublesome record of leadership in Alaska, those also add to their concerns.
Has there been any official response to that idea of reopening the search?
The search committee chairman, Michael Grebe, he addressed why the committee named one finalist. He said, you know, that Dr. Johnson was the committee's top choice from pretty early on in the process. And when all of the other finalists backed out of being publicly named because, you know, they wanted to be able to respond to the coronavirus crisis on their own campuses, they considered adding a semi-finalist's name into the mix, but they thought that that would be unfair to that particular applicant. And it was also disingenuously designed to create a perception that there's multiple finalists when they had already agreed that they liked Dr. Johnson. So, and they have considered like restarting the search, but he said that doing this would delay a hiring timeline by at least 6 months. And to do that at a time when campuses are desperately in need of leadership through the coronavirus, he says that they weren't for that. So in the end, they decided to just name Dr. Johnson as the sole finalist.
So what are the next steps then in this process?
Yeah, so the search committee will make their recommendation to the full Board of Regents, and then from there, the full board will vote on whether to hire Dr. Johnson. And then presumably if the vote goes his way, he will begin in the next couple of weeks or months.
Let's talk a little bit about, what's at stake. This is a big job. The UW system involves a lot of campuses, a lot of people, a lot of economic activity attached to it. Can you talk about, the enormity of this job that they're trying to fill?
Yeah, so the UW system, there's 26 campuses, more than 170,000 students, nearly 40,000 employees. The president's main job is sort of overseeing the chancellors, as well as advocating for the system and for state money and federal funding. It's a really big job. It's a really important search. And I'm sorry. I don't know what else
That's
to
okay.
say.
That's fine. Yeah, we'll watch to see what happens. Kelly, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Okay, thanks.
That's Kelly Meyerhofer, higher education reporter at the Wisconsin State Journal. She joined us today to update us on the search for a new UW system president. Well, are you watching this? Is this something that affects your life? If you're a student, you work at the UW system, you have a student there, or you're just an interested observer in what goes on at this big higher education institution here in Wisconsin. Love to know what you think about all this, the idea of reopening the search, what you've heard about this candidate so far. You can follow news stories about it, of course, at WPR.org/news, and you can let us know what you think. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR. You can send us an email, ideas@WPR.org, or head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page and comment on the news stories you see over there on the issue. Coming up after the news, it's our weekly look at some of the latest stories in national politics. One of the biggest ones this week we're following, efforts in Congress to introduce a police reform bill. House Democrats have a plan in place. Senate Republicans looking at their own options for what they want to do. And we're going to ask you to weigh in on those issues as well. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, House Democrats unveiled a wide-ranging police reform bill this week. We'll talk about what's in it and what support it's getting during our look at the week in Washington. First, protesters across Wisconsin and the country are calling for change. Marches, rallies, and other events continue in the wake of George Floyd's death and police custody in Minneapolis last month. But what specific changes do protesters want? WPR Morning Edition host Melissa Engels spoke recently with WPR State Capitol Laurel White and asked her who the protesters are and what they're hoping to achieve.
It's very important to note that this is not one group, certainly across the state. It's not one kind of organized effort. There are multiple groups across Wisconsin, even multiple groups in individual cities and counties that are kind of coming together to make these protests happen. So each community, you know, each city has their own needs, right? And their own requests. So there's certainly variation across Wisconsin in what these protesters want, but we're definitely seeing some like main themes emerge as well, some sort of like top line requests that we're not just seeing in Wisconsin, but really across the whole country.
What would the top three requests in terms of prominence or frequency, what would those be?
I think it's safe to say, based on, you know, our reporting, that the big three are the movement to, one, defund the police. I'm sure listeners have heard that phrase before at this point. The second would be to remove police from schools. And I think the third is kind of a broad request to reallocate government spending kind of writ large away from certain programs and into programs that support Black communities.
I see. What does defund the police mean? Who would have the power to do something like that?
I think that's a great question. And I've seen kind of on social media and in other places conversations about this. And I think that there is some kind of confusion about what it might mean because people see defund and they think maybe, you know, zeroing out the budget for something. And that's really not the case with the defund the police movement necessarily. It could mean, the statement could mean kind of a partial funding cut for police, kind of removing some of the resources, reallocating them. You know, in some instances, it is zeroing out the budget. We've seen some protesters in Milwaukee talking about the complete removal of police from their communities. So there's a wide range, really, of what that means, from little cuts to a total zeroing out. The entities that have the power to do that are really local government. So your local city council oversees the budget for your city police department. County boards oversee the budget for county sheriff's offices, and the state budget goes to the state patrol. So each local government entity that has, jurisdiction over their local law enforcement would have to make that decision on a case-by-case basis.
So police in the schools, who can remove police from schools?
So I reached out to the State Department of Public Instruction to clarify this, and they confirmed that because Wisconsin is a local control state, this is a decision that's really up to local school boards across Wisconsin. We've seen in Madison protesters actually go to the school board president's house to request this. So this is, again, a very individual kind of community by community decision that would have to take place.
You mentioned more government money for Black communities. Who makes those decisions? And do protesters have any specific requests around that?
Some of the specific things that protesters want are, funding going to things like mental health counseling for Black communities. We've talked about a trauma in Black communities, processing that. Other things like school funding, that's a primary issue. We hear a lot about education funding. Other things include replacing lead pipes. We know that that's been a big issue in a number of Wisconsin communities and has had a real effect on communities of color in the state. And then another thing is just kind of putting more government resources behind supporting and encouraging the growth of Black-owned businesses.
All right. Capitol reporter Laurel White, thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure.
That was Laurel White talking to WPR's Melissa Engels about protesters and what they're hoping to achieve with their actions. Now we're taking a look at the week in Washington. Senate Republicans are keeping another coronavirus relief bill on hold. President Trump is getting criticism for tweeting out a conspiracy theory about a protester injured by police. And House Democrats unveiled a package of police reform legislation on Monday. It includes a ban on chokeholds, anti-lynching legislation, and much more. Republicans in the Senate say they're working to craft their own police reform bill. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What role do you want to see Congress play in issues of policing, race, and the use of force, if any role? What do you think of the bill introduced in the House this week? Do you see this as necessarily a partisan issue or something you think both parties can work on together? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Sarah Ferris is a congressional reporter for Politico. Sarah, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, on Monday, we had House Democrats introducing their Justice in Policing Act. There's a lot. What are some of the high points, some of the main points of this bill?
Well, it's really hard to understate just how big this bill is and just how fast Democrats are moving. I mean, this is a caucus that was really poised for this already. They have a very diverse membership, many of whom who have worked on these issues for a long time. So they were able to package together reform provisions that have been around for a really long time. I mean, the ban on chokeholds is not a new bill. These bills to create commissions to study the societal effects on Black men and boys, that's not a new bill. There's a lot more in there. There's provisions to really tighten the transparency requirements for police. There's bills to crack down on the use of force. There's provisions that would eliminate some of the legal protections that officers have had to be able to protect them from civil lawsuits. This is really a wide-ranging bill. And what's really remarkable is we're not seeing the kind of resistance from either Republicans or moderate Democrats on this bill. There really is a good amount of consensus, and Republicans would rather talk about other issues versus than really digging into some of the Democratic proposals they don't like.
Yeah, I believe I saw Wisconsin Republican James Sensenbrenner in the House saying he liked at least one part of this that would make it, I believe, easier for departments to get rid of police officers who violate laws and violate norms. So there is at least some Republican support for some of this bill, it sounds like.
Absolutely. I mean, if you look at the provisions in this, some of the public approval on these is very high. And one thing Republicans don't want to do, especially in an election year, is to go against provisions that a vast majority of Americans support, or even a majority. So we're going to see over the next few weeks, Republicans are going to have to take a position on exactly what parts of this bill they support. And there's a lot of different perspectives. I mean, you have some of the more libertarian Republicans who don't want to see overreaching government. Some of them do support banning chokeholds. Some of them do support eliminating this so-called qualified immunity, legal protections. But there's others in the same Republican Party who feel very strongly against it. So I think this is going to be an issue. We see more divisions in the Republican Party than in the Democratic Party, which, as I mentioned, is an incredibly diverse caucus in both the House and Senate as well.
Let's look at one thing that's not in this bill. As I understand it, a lot of protesters have prominently called for defunding of police departments. Now, a lot of that is focusing on local and state levels. Is there any kind of defunding or budget cutting when it comes to police support in this House Democratic bill?
No. So there is nothing in here that would change the allocations to any police groups or to the Department of Justice in any way. Really, that's not Congress's job. As you mentioned, that's a state and local issue. What Democrats have tried to do is strike this balance. They know that the activists, either on the streets or the ones who have been working on this issue for a long time, when they say defund the police, a lot of them are saying reimagine the work of police. Most of them are not talking about eliminating funding for these departments or abolishing the departments altogether. What really the discussion has been about, especially in Washington, is how can we rethink where this money is going, how it's being spent, and how much of this is going to go towards actual patrol officers on the ground, and how much can go to social services. Should a police officer be responding to a person experiencing homelessness? Should a police officer be responding to someone who's looking to steal food because they are food insecure? There's a lot of big questions that have been arising from this movement. The struggle by Democrats, of course, is how do you talk about this in a nuanced way on the national level at a time when Republicans really just want to weaponize this, quote, defund the police movement. I mean, this is something that there's a lot of emotion, this is something that the Democrats risk losing the general public if they can't figure out how to message this properly.
George Floyd's brother, Philonis, testified in front of the House Judiciary Committee today. Here's a listen to some of what he had to say.
I couldn't take care of George that day. He was killed. But maybe by speaking with you today, I can make sure that his death would not be in vain. To make sure that he is more than another face on a T-shirt, more than another name on a list that won't stop growing.
There have been questions about how and if protests would result in real policy change. Sounds like Philonis Floyd there is trying to make that connection. And it seems like members of Congress are listening, at least trying to do something here.
Yeah, the hearing is still going on. It's been going on for more than 7 hours at this point. There's been some really emotional testimonies from not just these witnesses, but also the members themselves. There's a congresswoman from Georgia, Lucy McBath. Her son was killed. Her son, who was African-American, was killed by a white man over a dispute over loud music that he was playing. This is something that she's relived in various moments in Congress, and she became emotional today talking about her work to crack down on this type of issue. I mean, it's really bringing together members across the caucus who have had personal experiences with this, and it's become a very emotional moment for everyone in Congress. And I think that's why we haven't seen too many Republicans in Congress rule out what they will not do. What we're seeing is a lot of Republicans, whether it's the Senate, the House, the White House, they're coming up with proposals, and they're still working on them. We haven't seen them. They're coming up with proposals of what they might want to see rather than trying to reject ideas that Democrats are putting on the table. This is a very careful move because, again, the public opinion is so strong for a lot of these measures.
We're talking to Sarah Ferris, congressional reporter for Politico, looking at the week in national politics. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to see from Congress when it comes to police, race, violence? Does Congress need to act? Should it be left to the local level? If you want to see action from Congress, based on what you've heard, how's Democrats proposing there? What ideas do you like? Do they go far enough? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation, check out what's going on in the Senate coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Sarah Ferris, congressional reporter for Politico, looking at the top national political news this week. We've been talking about efforts in Congress to pass bills on police reform. Talk about the House so far. Let's head over to the Senate now. I want to give a listen to Mitch McConnell, Senate Majority Leader, talking about the issue yesterday.
About here in the Senate Republican Conference is what we think is the appropriate response to the events of the last few weeks. And under the leadership and guidance of Senator Tim Scott, at some point in the near future, we'll have recommendations to be made.
McConnell referencing Senator Tim Scott, the one African-American Republican in the Senate. Do we have any indication of the kinds of things that they might be looking at, Sarah?
So what we know so far that Senator Tim Scott, who's leading this effort, is looking at, right now there's a lot of focus on increasing training, to focus on de-escalation tactics. There's a lot of focus on how to better equip officers, you know, to make sure they're not partaking in racist actions on the job. There's less interest, and in some cases, almost no interest in some of the major items that Democrats have laid out in their legislation, banning chokeholds, these no-knock warrants in drug-related cases in which officers can enter a residence without knocking or ringing the doorbell. There's also not as much interest for eliminating this legal doctrine that would essentially shield officers from being the subject of civil lawsuits. So there's a really wide range of ways that you can go about this. What most Democrats see is a need to go after not just the transparency and the training, but also to make these big structural reforms requiring officers to wear body cameras, for example. They want to really change the way that policing is done. And what Tim Scott and a lot of his Republican colleagues are instead looking at are ways to improve the existing training. This wouldn't be structural changes to the department, but just shoring up the resources that are already there to prevent this kind of racism from existing in the departments. And so this is really going to be the major fight over the next 2 or 3 weeks. The White House will, I'm sure, get involved, and it will have changed some of the Republicans' minds on this, so we could see a bit of back and forth. But we're just going to see how far they're willing to go in accepting what the Democrats have proposed already.
We're talking to Sarah Ferris from Politico, looking at some of the top stories in national politics this week. Let's turn to another story now. Amidst all the protests, President Trump got backlash from a lot of people, Democrats in particular, some mild criticism from Senate Republicans this week for tweeting out a conspiracy theory, basically, about a 75-year-old protester in Buffalo who was injured by police. Can you remind us what happened in that incident, and then take us up to this story that the president retweeted?
Right. So what you're talking about is this video of the encounter between the 75-year-old man, Martin Giugino, and two Buffalo police officers. And this basically went viral, and the number of Senate Republicans who either couldn't respond or wouldn't respond to what the president had tweeted was really remarkable. My colleagues were on Capitol Hill asking senators about this. Specifically, Trump is saying, you know, that this protester was pushed away after appearing to scan police communications in order to black out the equipment. That was the accusation that Trump was perpetuating with his Twitter account. And I mean, this was something that had no basis for it. There's a lot of Republicans who are already trying to figure out how to balance support for these nationwide protests, which are multiracial, multigenerational. They really don't want to be seen as condemning the protests, but at the same time, they're trying to maintain this sort of law and order perspective. So this tweet from Trump really just threw yet another wrench in this conversation and forcing them to respond to yet another Trump tweet that they would rather not. And at some point, so many Republicans were saying they hadn't seen the tweet that there were reporters who printed out a copy of it and were handing it out to senators so that they could read it and then respond.
And this is a never-ending question, I think, for the media and for members of Congress, how seriously to take the president's tweets. But today at a White House press conference, he had printed off a series of tweets on an unrelated issue, handed out to all reporters, and then referenced by the press secretary. So at least in some instances, they're being treated as, you know, official presidential statements.
That's right. The president was saying that he was rejecting calls from some in the protest movement to rename some of these forts that exist across the country, which have had Confederate backgrounds. And the president was rejecting, said, we're not going to do this. I mean, this is a distraction that the president has really perfected in his several years in office. Just as the news is starting to pile up for him, there was a CNN poll that showed him way behind Vice President Joe Biden in this election coming up. And he threatened to sue CNN in a tweet over the results of this poll, which CNN said is the first time that there's a president ever trying to force legal action over a poll. So, you know, we've just seen that the president has tried to bring in other issues. He knows that if he brings up a random topic or goes on a tangent like this, reporters will follow in a lot of cases. And so what he's doing is distracting from some of these major, major issues. I mean, this is a very volatile time in American politics. The president is at the center of this. He has to deal with the coronavirus crisis. There's been 15 days of protests across the country, and there's so much else when you look at what he has to deal with. So, you know, the tweets are just one way to, talk to his base directly. He wants to make sure they're engaged, make sure they're, that they're behind him heading into November.
I want to touch on coronavirus relief bills in Congress. Last month, the Democrats had passed a $3 trillion coronavirus relief package. Didn't get taken up by the Senate. I don't think anybody really expected it to. Is there any talk on the Senate side of things of working toward more economic relief for the impact of coronavirus?
So in the last couple of weeks, the answer is yes. The Senate Republicans, led by Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, have finally started to talk about what more will be needed. And this is a change because for several weeks they had said, you know, we've already spent more than $3 trillion. Let's just wait and see where that money goes, what will be needed. But in the last really week or so, we've started to see a change. And with 40 million people unemployed, with parts of the economy very slowly starting to reopen, of course, not bringing back jobs as quickly as some want, though we did get a bit of good economic news last week with jobs starting to be added back, there is a clear need for more aid. And what's really going to be a challenge is there's several expiring provisions of existing legislation that will go away at the end of July. Now, specifically, that's the $600 per week in extra unemployment money that has been helping millions of people who are on unemployment get through this pandemic, who just otherwise would not have been able to make it on the regular unemployment. So that extra money that's been helping millions of people, that will go away at the end of July. There's a lot of Republicans who say we don't need to be, additionally, essentially subsidizing this for people. They say the economy is reopening. Restaurants and other retail outlets are having a hard time bringing people back because they might make more on unemployment. The Republicans are ready to let that provision expire and just say it back to regular unemployment rules. Democrats, however, say that the coronavirus pandemic is, of course, still a factor, and there are many people who are afraid to go back to work or who wouldn't be safe to do so. So they will be pushing for a renewal of these benefits. So, of course, that will be a major fight to look forward to. And I think that will be, other than the police reform, this will be the other main focus in both the House and Senate going into the August recess.
We'll keep watching that, Sarah. Thanks for joining us again.
All right. Thank you. Take care.
You too. That's Sarah Ferris, congressional reporter for Politico. She joined us for a look at the top national stories in politics. Here on Central Time, we are always fans of unexpected animal sightings. So here are a few from around Wisconsin. UW system schools have been quiet places lately, but UW-Platteville got a campus tour from an unexpected visitor. On Monday, Platteville police posted on their Facebook page that a large black bear was spotted wandering around on campus. Quote, the DNR has been contacted and we are advising folks to just leave the big fella alone. End quote. Sounds like good advice to me. Now, bears, that's not too unusual for Wisconsin. So how about a kangaroo? Police in Franklin, just south of Milwaukee, got a report of a kangaroo on the loose in a neighborhood. It was ultimately captured and returned without incident to its owner. It was a pet kangaroo, it turns out. As the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reports, there is no state law restricting kangaroo ownership. But check your local laws before you go out and buy a pet kangaroo. And I guess do a lot of homework first. Also, there have been sightings of a group of 40 or so goats wandering around some parks in Madison. Now, that one's on purpose. The goats are part of an ongoing experiment to help control invasive species. And finally, if you're looking to spot some unusual animals in the state, there's some good news on the horizon. The Milwaukee County Zoo is planning to open up their outdoor exhibits this Saturday with some special social distancing rules in place, so check out their website before you go. We'll get some more advice later in the show talking about great things to do in Wisconsin this time of year. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.